The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm Neil Zacharias, and you're listening to Eat for the Planet. On this show, we try to answer the question, how can we eat in a way that nourishes us without starving the planet? The show features conversations with food industry leaders, health and sustainability experts, as well as entrepreneurs and creative minds who are redefining the future of food. This episode is part of a series of episodes produced in collaboration with Plant-Based World Expo. The European edition of the Expo will be the biggest 100% plant-based professional event in Europe and is scheduled to take place November 30th and December 1st, 2022 in London, UK. Alexis Gauthier, my guest on this episode of the podcast, will be one of the featured speakers at the event. Alexis Gauthier, thank you so much for joining us on the Eat for the Planet podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
This may sound like a very simple question for me to start off with, but you can take it anywhere you want to, but why do you love food?
Why do I love food? Actually, I love food because it's one of the few real pleasure you have in life, you know, being healthy, having taste buds, and constantly looking for something that's going to give you pleasure. I think food is such a wonderful source of pleasure. For, you know, life is too short not to constantly looking for the pleasure, and food is give you so much pleasure. So I think that's why I love food. I'm actually fascinated by food. My entire life is around food. You know, so that's really me.
Yeah, and obviously you started pretty early with your interest in food. Can you take us back to what was the first spark where you thought maybe this is something I want to dedicate the rest of my life to?
Well, I don't know whether there had been one moment in my life, but obviously coming growing up in south of France, with grandmothers, you know, like a lot of French chefs, who knew recipes, delicious recipes, and most importantly, we're cooking with love. And I was lucky to be cooked for by people who I think really loved me. So they were putting everything they had, you know, into the way they fed me, and I really received it and I felt it. And I think that's where the love for food came. And then obviously the love for cooking. I love experimenting. And I remember doing crepes for my sisters. Maybe that was a way for me to showing her love, and I don't know, and making cakes for my friends. And it was a tool of expressing my love for other people. So I was lucky enough to transform that into my job, and I've never looked back.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you kind of answered my follow-up question, which was really going to be, what do you want your food to express? And I think you sort of answered that, is that you were using your food to express love to others. How's that changed and evolved over the years now that you've been involved on the business side of food too and have been, you know, run several restaurants? Has that changed? Has that expanded or contracted over the years?
Oh, yes, definitely expanded. And I think the maturity of the human being going through the life and getting older and older helps you to transform this desire to express love into a desire to do something meaningful through love, and that probably moved into a slightly more philosophical way of looking at how to express love and what I can do as you know, with this love, and then I think it matured into something bigger, like altruism, it's a sort of love too, and all of this blend into what I was doing, I think, is making the person I am at the moment.
And you know, let's just take a typical diner that comes into one of your restaurants in London. Let's just take Gautier Soho. What kind of experience are you trying to have them? Are you trying to provide for them? Do you really? I'm sure you think a lot about that, both in terms of the food, but also the entire environment in which they're consuming the food. Is that something that you can sum up in a few words?
Well, I think I'm always positioned myself as a customer. So when I design the restaurant and the experience people are paying for, because they are paying for it and they want to have a full experience. And it's an experience I've dreamt. So an experience of delicious food with a strong Frenchness in it, because they are also buying into who I am, and you know, I'm a French chef, so they want to have that as an experience, and the experience has to be memorable. So there is so many things that comes into the equation: the way we serve, the story we have to say, the season we are in, the way I cook, until the moment they leave. Mm-hmm. I think it's a whole package, and it's always on my mind. I'm always thinking over and over about it and hoping that every day is getting better and better for the customer's experience.
Yeah, and you mentioned you're obviously a French chef. You've been classically trained, and your restaurant has reflected that since you launched, I believe, in the year 2010.
That's right.
But even looking back to the early days of you as a chef, you've always had a bit of a focus on vegetables. So this isn't necessarily something that only happened within the last 6 years or so. But there was a bit of a moment in 2016 when you personally started to change the way you ate, and slowly your restaurant started to reflect that in the menu. Tell us a little bit more about your passion for vegetables and plants, and then how did that evolve as your restaurant grew?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long story, and it's really you know, throughout my life, as I said about my grandmothers who were cooking for me, because I came from south of France. You know, vegetables were, you know, a massive part of the local recipes. I remember my grandmother doing some aubergine stew, and when I was starving, I will have this aubergine stew, and it will be so delicious that now every time I'm starving, I'm dreaming of having an aubergine stew. So, and then after I was lucky, very lucky, to work with Alain Ducasse in Monte Carlo, where Alain Ducasse really was the first three Michelin star chef who introduced an entire menu, an entire tasting menu or gastronomic menu around vegetables. Obviously, the restaurant was based in Monaco, and there is the influence of Provence from the west, and there is the influence of Italy and the north of Italy on the east. So it's perfect combinations to find inspiration and perfect ingredients all year long. And then after that, I was again super lucky to work as a private chef for a family in San Francisco, actually. And this family in San Francisco had a farm in Atherton, which is, you know, right in the middle of the Silicon Valley, but in the early 90s, that was just, you know, somewhere rich people from San Francisco had like summer houses, and they had this massive farm there with all sorts of you know, obviously seasonal vegetables and fruits. And I will go in the morning and talk to the gardener, and I will tell him what I was hoping to be cooking. And he will just pick vegetables for me, and then I will prepare those vegetables for this family. And I did that for, you know, almost 2 years, and that really helped me to develop my own personality when it came to creating recipes or interpreting vegetables. And then I came to London, and obviously, you know, opened my first restaurant. And there was a tasting menu around vegetables, and vegetables have always been, you know, mainly the center of my inspiration. Then I wrote a book called Vegetronic in 2000 and, 12, where, you know, vegetables were really the center of the dish, but there was still, I was still using animal product. And then I had people outside my restaurant one day complaining that I was using foie gras, which now thinking back, I feel so ashamed about, but, you know, hey, that's life. And then discussing with them the impact of me serving that had on the animals, starting to push me to look more into animal consciousness and the impact I was having through my jobs on the on other people. And I read a book called Antispecist, which is a French book by a journalist called Aymeric Caron. And when I finished this book, I thought to myself, hey, now I know what I know. It's impossible for me to carry on being the person I was before I started this book. So my first decision was to obviously become vegan immediately. And then I decided that I will transform my restaurant into this, you know, gastronomy, French gastronomic temple, into a French vegan gastronomic temple. And slowly, slowly, we removed all the animals and all our creative stuff was around vegetable, plant-based. And I'm so glad now there is, obviously, you know, for the last now, you know, year and a half, 2 years, he has been fully plant-based, and I'm so proud of that, and I'm so glad, and I'm so relieved. But and now I feel like, you know, I need to convince the world, you know, through my cuisine, and with the help of my cuisine, that we are not on this planet to eat other people sharing this planet with us. We are far too smart and intelligent and sensitive and all sorts of things.
Wow. I mean, I have so many questions there, but let's just go back to 2016, because it almost sounds like your decision to think about the issue and read a book about it could have been career ending in some ways, right? Because the heart of classical French cooking or gastronomy, it almost is, if you think about it from a traditional sense, it's almost impossible to imagine it without the use of animal products.
Absolutely, that was a challenge. I was ready to take it. There was absolutely no way. I mean, what kind of human being I would have been after knowing what I knew in depth, supported by science, that I could not only continue profiting, but refusing to accept the facts, you know, this, it was just not possible. But yes, you're right. It could have been a massive, it could have been the end. And a lot of people have told me, my gosh, you're crazy. And that not only involved my customers, obviously, who were very upset, or my old supporters, but my employees, who were thinking, oh my gosh, you know, I've got, you know, two kids. I've been working with you for 10, 15 years. And what are you doing? Are you trying to starve my family? Are you trying to destroy this business? You know what? It was a crazy thing to do, but now I'm looking back, I think that was the rational thing to do. And to be fair, economically, it has been unbelievable, because of course I wasn't the only one to realize that at the time I was realizing it. There was huge number of people who were transiting, who wanted to change the way they ate, because the information is now widely available. And especially in UK, which was the place where I think it's quite influential for me, but the Cambridge declarations on consciousness, which is a simple paper that recognizes once and for all that the animal we eat don't want to be eaten. Of course, they don't want to die. Of course, they want to be loved. Of course, they want to love. They have hopes, just like all of us. And yeah. So anyway, I wasn't the only one, and that's why my restaurant kept being filled up, and we could continue, and that also opened for me great opportunities to become a new kind of chef in terms of creativity and looking at the creative skills that I had very differently, and working with my team and my suppliers, and interpreting the seasons around me, and everything that influenced me was completely, you know, challenged, and that was really, really, really wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, it's such an interesting fact that this decision and this change that you experienced was back in 2016, where, you know, now looking back, in the last, say, 3 to 4 years, there have been a lot of restaurants, food companies that have started to talk about using less animals in their supply chain, mostly from a sustainability angle. Yeah. And it's interesting to note that your decision was not necessarily driven by sustainability. It was merely the fact that you just didn't want to use animals anymore. And you came to a realization that they were beings and you didn't want to use them as part of your food, which is quite different from what most motivations are for a lot of people these days.
I know. But you know what? This is, I mean, of course, it doesn't upset me because, you know, everybody can see where they're yeah. But we tell our customers everywhere we can, you know, at every corner of our company, you know, the message is very simple, is we are doing it for the animals. That's all, you know. The animals are at the center of our process. The love we have for them is why we are doing. Why we are doing that? We want to leave them alone to enjoy this planet, just like we will do, and to let them alone and not to eat them, because they don't want to be eaten. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And all this. I mean, of course, it's good when people stop eating animals because they want to do it for the planet. And but my worry is there is always a little bit of room mm-hmm. for justifying eating a little bit. And there is absolutely no way we should have one. You know, this is we are not on this planet for that. We are not meant to kill. We are not meant to feed ourselves with animals. And I've got no idea where we went wrong, but I'm working very hard to rectify the slight mistake that happened in us as a human.
Yeah, especially as we've, you know, evolved and come now in the year 2022, we have the opportunity to have the benefit of science and knowledge and access to different kinds of foods. It's almost it's not such a hard choice to make. It just requires some reimagining. Were you always just one more question on this, but I do want to talk about what you did with your food, but were you always an animal lover? I'm just curious because it was that something that was always part of your life, and no. Then this just sort of was no. An evolution.
No. Exactly. That's the thing. I have never ever worried about or cared about animal in the past, and this is, I think, I was hardwired, and I really feel bad. I mean, it's not my road to redemption, or you know, I. Even let me tell you something. Even after, you know, reading the book and deciding to be vegan and changing my business, I walk in a supermarket and I see dead chicken under cling film. It should make me sad, but it doesn't. And if I see someone next to me having a fillet of beef, I have to force myself to connect the dots, to connect the steak with the animal who mm-hmm. did not want to die, and that, I think that's the hardest part. And I know that's a reason why people, as much as they would like to be, you know, nice with animals, and we are so hardwired, you know, since we were born, about this disconnection between what we've got in our plates and the animals we see, you know, growing or eating the grass in the field. And it's the same for me. So, and I really feel bad about that. I'm hoping that as I get older, the dots are getting connected, and I will feel. And that's also, and I understand why people, despite all of their knowledge, cannot do the, you know, the total move towards a plant-based diet. And this is where, as a chef, I have such huge responsibilities to create a delicious food that makes you, you know, forget that, you know, you want. It's a bit like, you know, I don't know, it's a bit like smokers, you know, in the past. You know, they say, oh, I can't live without cigarettes. And then one day they live without cigarettes because nobody smokes around them. And I think the shift to is going to be quite similar.
Yeah, you kind of need both, you know, some things to change from a systemic standpoint, both in terms of food production and distribution. But I think the even more powerful one is the cultural mindset or fabric that we all kind of are blinded by and trapped under, right? So as you said, it kind of needs a bit of a rewiring of our neural networks that have just evolved and been passed on through generations.
Yeah, but I think the shortcut is deliciousness. And that's what I always talk about, food being delicious. That's what I always talk to other chefs and ask them to put their creative skills into the mix, because the more we are to create impossible to resist delicious plant-based food, the more we will be able to convince people. I think the whole thing about making them feel guilty or telling them that the planet is burning, or there will always be a little bit of space to, oh, okay, well, the other one is gonna stop eating animals. I carry on, you know, because we are so many, you know, don't worry about me. And I think if it's delicious, if the food is delicious, you just forget about it. And that's why chefs are so much more powerful than someone who is going to lecture you about animal consciousness, or someone who is going to do you an exposé about the risk of this planet, you know, ending soon. But if I give you something which is seriously delicious, and then you decide you cannot live without eating that, that will be mission accomplished.
Yeah. That I mean, I've realized that over. Now, I've been vegan myself for 12 years now, and at first, I felt like knowledge was the problem, and that if only everyone knew, we would all make the right choice.
Yes, but that's not always the case.
That's not always the case. And at the end of the day, it's almost forgetting what food is, right? Food food is pleasure, right? And we can't forget about that aspect of food. You can maybe intellectually connect the dots and think, I need to change the way I eat. But at the end of the day, when you sit down to eat and you've got, you know, limited time and maybe limited money in some cases, you choose what you're used to.
And
you
choose what you love. There is one thing that really I read recently, studies showing that there are still more ex-vegan on this planet than vegan, and of course the reason for that is, despite all the good intentions, despite all the, you know, the thinking and the conclusion, the intellectual conclusions of one's thoughts into, okay, I need to become a vegan, there would be a point in their life when they say, oh, you know what, I cannot live without this roast chicken. I cannot live without this sushi. I cannot live without, oh my gosh. And how many times have I heard that to justify a, you know, go back into the world of animal eating? And again, that's why the position of a chef is so key, because you don't have to. I can make something that tastes as good as a I don't know, a California roll, or as a tuna roll, or the roast chicken. Don't worry. And the ingenuity of the human being is now working so hard to replace what you think you cannot live without, that I'm very hopeful.
So take us back to, say, 2016 when you first started to transition your menu. I know you didn't do it overnight. Obviously, you had an established restaurant. You had regulars who loved the food that you were making up until that point. And now here you are breaking the rules and doing something that was slightly outside of the norm when it comes to, French gastronomy, for example. So how did that process go about? How did you make the change to the menu? And walk us through those years, because I know it continued up till the pandemic, and then obviously things changed.
So what I was doing is to remove all the creativity in menu designing. So from this moment, there will be no more new recipes involving animal product. So that forced us to, when we wanted to bring a new starters or a new main course, say in summer or in spring, it will be purely plant-based. So that every time there was one dish that qualified to be present on the menu, that will remove one animal-based product. But of course, we had to make sure that the transition made sense, because we couldn't just start serving green lettuce and tofu, as a starter. We had the Frenchness that was totally part of our DNA. So, yeah, we were thinking about the flavors. We were thinking about the texture. We were thinking about obviously the retrofaction of when you taste, the richness of a French starter, for example, usually express, the animal and the perfect animal. So it took a lot. It took a lot of research and attempt to recreate that. But ultimately, every time we, whether we were doing some sauce or we were doing some new sauce, a new combination of ingredients, the ultimate flavors was never too different from when the animal was involved. Why? Because I realized that the animal who we are eating are the animal that eat plant. We never eat an animal that eats another animal. That's not in the French gastronomy anyway. That's very rare. And so actually the animals tasted of its own food. So if you, and the only thing missing was the fat, the animal fat, the roasting of the animal fat. But the depth of flavor, we could duplicate it very easily. So it was a complicated process sometimes, especially in the pastry section, but it wasn't an impossible process. And I'm so glad to say that it's probably a natural process. That's why we could unlock and create some dishes that people think it reflect Frenchness, it reflect gastronomy, and they are happy to pay a lot of money for it. So long process, still in the making, but it's a wonderful it's a wonderful time to be a chef, I can tell you.
And what's your approach to menu development? Are you relying strictly on whole food ingredients or vegetables, or do you also experiment with, as you know, there's several products now in the market that mimic meat, cheese, eggs, butter, cream. So do you turn to those, or are you developing everything in-house?
So we've got two avenues that we take. There is the pure one avenue is a pure new creative French vegan gastronomy. Mm-hmm. What is it? It's something completely crazy. As far as if you were looking at it 10 years ago and you look at it now, you think, my gosh, what are you doing? It's a gastronomy that involves aubergine in puddings and wild strawberries in main course. It's a gastronomy that absolutely no boundaries other than the season that leads us. So we are in London and we've got four seasons and we've got ingredients that comes in spring and different than in summer and in winter. And really that's the start of the inspiration process. And then nothing that stops us. We think about texture. We think about what we can add to add a new dimension in the product. But say we work with Salsify at the moment, and we transform Salsify. We transform the texture of the Salsify while retaining its depth of flavor, and then we merge that with something bitter that you would have never done that in French gastronomy, and then we add an element that comes and balances the sweetness of the dish at the end, and that's really exciting. That's a modernity. That's mm-hmm. But that's gastronomy. It's complicated. It takes a lot of time to make. Involves a lot of chefs. And on the other hand, we have the 3D printing piece of meat. So you were talking about new kind of ingredients. So of course we want to use them. We want to. This is a modernity. This is also the way. We don't want to sound artisan. We want mm-hmm. to sound progressist. So. Those companies who make, I'll give you an example of 3D printing meat. They make those 3D printing meat because they are like us. They want the world to stop eating animals. So we are going to use them, and we are going to inflict them the same kind of Frenchness. We're going to inflict them the same kind of gastronomy that we will have done in the past to a rack of lamb, for example. So it's going to be marinated with red wine from south of France, and there are going to be a lot of onions and bay leaves and thyme and garlic, and we are going sous vide for a night, and then after we are going slowly roast it and braise it, and then we are going to reduce the sauce, and we are going to find that it actually tastes as good as something we would have done 10 years ago, except obviously nobody's dead. And this is mission accomplished again. So it's really two ways. There is the future of gastronomy, which is going to look very much like the past, but it's also a future which is going to look totally wild and exciting, and it's the opposite of the current French gastronomy, which is anchored in old mm-hmm. recipe written 120 years ago by Auguste Escoffier, and chefs spend their life trying to photocopy this recipe and making sure that it tastes the same as when it was done 100 years ago. And you've got all sorts of people who come and eat in their restaurants and tell them, yeah, it's almost as good as the one I've eaten 20 years ago. And this is the death of French gastronomy as far as I'm concerned. So if anything, the plant-based future of French gastronomy is the only way for it to survive and to mm-hmm. excel, and not to be dying like a very very old dusty thing.
And how did critics? I'm very curious. How did critics react to the changes that you were making? I mean, you were obviously very creative even before you started to transition your menu into being plant-based, and it wasn't like you were super traditional in the past. You were probably following the basic rules, but how did that get received? Because you were an established restaurant. It wasn't like you came out of nowhere and just started a new restaurant and were doing something different.
No,
you had to change people's perception of what you were.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We were known for being, one of those Michelin star gastronomic restaurant in a city like London. So you've got maybe 20 or 30, pretty much using all the same ingredients around the year. So we use, game in winter and venison, and then we move to lamb in spring, and we'll use, we'll do rich sauce with sometimes lobster, sometimes langoustine, sometimes the beef jus will be deep and reduced, and yes, that was us. And a lot of customers, they had been celebrating their wedding anniversary. I don't know, they're. And the guides, one in particular called the Michelin Guide, wasn't very impressed when we started to develop a future which was going to be very different to the past we had been sticking with. But that's, I was worried about that, but I, looking back now, I don't know why I worry about that, because the world was changing and all customers, some of them transitioned with us. Some of them got really upset and, you know, were really nasty, because how could I change the restaurant they love so much? And I had thousands of customers who were faithful and will come, you know, every other week for some pieces of animals cooked the French way in my restaurant. And then we removed that, and they were really upset and they were really nasty. But on the other hand, I had so many new customers who were kind, supportive, understanding, sharing the same vision of the future that I had. And those people really supported me, and now we are not looking back. We are looking to the future.
Yeah, I hate to take you back to a dark time, but you know, I feel like I cannot talk to a chef or anyone who runs a restaurant without bringing up the year 2020, and the start of the pandemic. How did it impact you? What happened? If you can walk us through that, because there's a silver lining to the story, because you reopened in 2021, and that's when you reopened as an entirely plant-based restaurant. But how was 2020? I can't imagine that was a good year for you.
Yeah, that was very stressful, because obviously now we look back and we can see what happened, and we can pinpoint the exact date where things happened. Yeah. But obviously we were totally blind of the future, and we didn't know whether this, you know, like everybody else, I guess. Where 2020 we had the first lockdown here in UK. I was hopeful that, you know, it wasn't going to last, and then of course it lingered, and maybe the first couple of months I didn't want to do anything. You know, with my staff, we just stay at home and we're hoping for a better day. And then I said, okay, well, maybe you know, we should start doing home kit. And as we were, to be honest, as we were not fully plant-based by then, I said, okay, maybe we are going to do some home kit, obviously plant-based, and maybe we've got one which still has animal product. And and the minute we promoted them, I could see that 95% of our books were purchased by people who wanted to eat plant-based. Obviously, the COVID pandemic had mm-hmm. an impact on people's perception of how they should be eating. Slight. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, well, we are just going to do some plant-based 100% vegan box home kit. And then every week we started to do the classic Gotiso box, and then we decided to because it was too boring to repeat the same box over and over, we started to explore the world, and that was an amazing experience for all of us. I mean, all of us, the people who were involved in the creation of plant-based cuisine, because it took us 1 week to Rio de Janeiro, and we were studying the plant-based delicacies of Brazil. The following week, we went to Vietnam and we did the Ho Chi Minh box. The week after, we went to Kinshasa and we did the African box. And then we went to South Africa, and then we went to Moscow, and we went to... So suddenly, we found inspiration all around the world. And that was fascinating. And the boxes were selling so well that every week, We sold out. And we realized that people were actually waiting for those books to arrive every Friday afternoon, because when they were stuck at home and they had these books coming and taking them somewhere exotic or somewhere yeah. fascinating, somewhere they were hoping to go, somewhere they were hopeful to maybe one day going, at least we were delivering some flavor of the destination while they could stay in their living room and be safe from COVID. So it was fascinating period. And even now we have stocked the box recently, and we get so much demand from our boxes, but we can't do everything, I'm afraid. So if there is another lockdown, we will start again the boxes. But at the moment, we concentrate on the restaurant.
No, but that's also a testament to your ability to create in a moment that you had to adapt, right? And it's, I guess everyone was forced to think outside the box and do something yes. different. But it's almost like, yeah, you can, now you stumbled into doing something that turned out to be so joyful and people now want it and don't want it to go away.
Absolutely. And sometimes I look back and say, oh my gosh, is there a business there? I mean, do I need to maybe, rent another kitchen and starting the box again? Because clearly, and I, of course, I only serve people who come to my restaurants. But we realized that we were selling boxes, hundreds of boxes in Scotland, boxes in Liverpool and Manchester and Midlands and Northern Ireland. And it's not everyone who... had the opportunity to have, a plant-based offering around the corner who could provide something, of this level at the price level we're saying. And so, maybe one day we'll start again and we'll go back on our journey of bringing the flavor of the vegan world around Great Britain.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's also another way to get more people to try the food and experience something that they probably previously would have never thought could be that delicious. So it all serves the cause, I suppose, at the end of the day. So you reopened in 2021 and that's when you had an entirely plant-based menu. How have things been since then? And, how would you sort of describe the food that someone would get in your restaurant if you were to go there today? And I'm hoping to visit there very soon. So yes, think of me as being the end customer who wants to know the answer here.
Yeah. So you need to come and try it, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about it. Obviously, we are offering one 8-course menu, 8-10 course, depending mm-hmm. on the, but the 8-10 course that reflects the season, reflects our degree of technicality in terms of what we are trying to achieve. And obviously, the mood we are in and whatever influences us comes into the mix. And it's usually something that goes crescendo. So, it's very, very green to start with, even though, in autumn, we don't have a lot of green things, but we've got a lot of, it starts with some green and then it gets darker. As we go along the menu, and in between there is a lot of surprising flavors, interesting texture, because that's interesting temperature as well, and I work with my sommelier and I work with my waiters to try to create an experience that not only, I mean, obviously, it's around the food because you come and get fed. But the message that my waiters have is aligned with the kind of things we do. So they might question you about, what's your position about animal consciousness, and we might ask you, do you know why we are doing that? And how do you see the future of this planet? I don't know. This is quite interesting because we do have a lot of vegan curious who mm-hmm. come to the restaurant. A lot of people who want to challenge us. A lot of people who want us to agree with them that yes, we should not eat animals, yet we should eat a little bit for X, Y, or Z reason. Mm-hmm. And somehow they seem to want to come here to convince us. and you can never win an argument with us because it's a question of life and death. And that's the end of it. That's just the end of it. There is no argument. But anyway, it's quite interesting for my employees to be able to have this kind of conversation. And And I always say, you know, we come and we bring the cross of what we are doing, and we plant it in the middle of the plate, of the table, every table, every night, to every customers. And we do it for the animals. And we are so proud. And we are so proud. And I can tell you, when people spend what they spend with us, I can tell you it's £95 per person just for the meal. And then they everybody drinks a little bit to enjoy. So the average spend is maybe £150, £200 per head. And when they leave the restaurant, they feel like they have really had value for money in a very gastronomic experience, when people who were talking to them were serious. They had a message, but they were professional. And they loved doing what they were doing, and it was delicious. It was surprising, and it reflected, you know, London 2022, and it's going to be completely different in 2 years' time. But that's the beauty of it.
Yeah,
and this is what we are selling, and this is the experience that you will have. You're going to have when you come to a restaurant, hopefully.
What you're doing is so different from anything I've seen, because, well, of course, there's, I mean, out here in the U.S., there's tons of all plant-based restaurants now. But no one's bold enough to bring up that issue and confront the guests with it, because the conventional thinking, and at least maybe research points to it, is that people want to just experience good food. They don't want to be preached to, and they don't want to be they don't want to be asked questions, or their values to be challenged, and that conventional wisdom. You look at it over here, every place that sells plant-based food, it's all about the food, and it's almost like even sustainability, maybe now in recent years, has been started to be brought up, because I think it's mostly used as a selling point. It's almost like a marketing tactic. And not to say it's not genuine in some cases, but in many cases it's used because they know people are more welcoming to talk about the planet than to talk about a life being taken for your food. But I think I find that commendable. I think it's brave. I think it's kind of risky, and maybe it's different in London.
No.
But
I come into this world as how I say, already established. Mm-hmm. Matured, and maybe I've been spending 20 years in this country, and the eccentricity of the British are slightly, but I've got nothing to lose, nothing to lose. I will at my last breath, the last day of my life, if I look back and I haven't been true to those believe and think, oh, maybe on that day I did not remind the person that what he was eating is a dead animals, I will feel guilty. I will feel guilty. And I don't want that. I want to bring this very clear message. This is so basic. This is why it's so, sometimes I have to excuse myself to my guests, and I say, yeah, it's gonna sound super childish, but we don't want to kill someone who did not want to die. And then I ask them, would you like to be eaten? And they, of course, they say no. Well, I said, well, if an animal could speak, it will tell you exactly the same. Of course it doesn't want to be eaten. I mean, it's so stupid and simple. And sometimes I can't believe people are still trying to argue, oh, yeah, but, you know, the animals, he was happy during his life. And I said, what is bullshit? What is that? I mean, are you having a... I mean, we are intelligent humans. We are better than that. If I tell you this person doesn't want to die, it doesn't want to die. End of the story. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, and then I think it also comes down to, because you have a lot of confidence in your own talents and abilities, and you've, as you said, you've had a successful career leading up to this point. And if you don't, you know, stand up for what you believe now, then when? Right. So it's almost.
No, and I was ready to lose everything I'd spent 25 years of my professional career to build. I was ready to lose everything, but I knew it was not going to happen. This is the thing, because if it happens to me, this kind of being enlightened, it will happen to thousands of people. You know, I don't think that I'm one special individual that sees the light and nobody else seen it.
And what's the response been from customers? I mean, I'm sure you've had several stories of people who, like, to what extent do you feel like you're helping change people's perceptions? How do you feel? Like, I know it's very tough to measure impact because you're one restaurant and yes, you serve thousands of customers, but how do you feel people's perceptions are starting to change? The very fact that you've been successful doing this now for a while is probably a good sign. But what else have you heard and seen that gives you hope?
Well, what I really hope is that more chefs will not be scared and will do the same thing as I have done. That's really where the difference is going to be. It's when London is full of restaurants like Gautier Soho, and on any other night you can choose between 15 restaurants like mine. At the moment, there aren't any other. So that's, I don't know. I'm hopeful. I can see the world is changing, but I can see how fragile it is also. And that's why I'm talking about the ex-vegan who outnumber the current vegan. I know how, and there is, you know, it's again the clock. You know, we are fighting against that, against people, you know, feeling really like not to be bothered anymore, or people who find weird to be not wanting to eat dead animals. This is the thing for me: people who eat animals are weird. Not the other way around, but until recently, a lot of people thought someone who doesn't eat animals is a weird one, but for me, it's not. The person who is, and I think people are starting to. I mean, my sister, I think she doesn't talk to me, and she's lives in France. And 2 years ago, she will not make me feel like I was the weird one, you know. Not to, but now when I talk to her, she's trying very hard not to make me think that she's the weird one. If you know what I mean. So I think things are shifting. And now people meet me, and very often the first thing they say, oh, we don't eat a lot of meat. Or, you know, they're trying to don't start thinking that we don't know what it is all about. So I think for that, I'm very hopeful that people are starting to, you know, they can see that they're feeling slightly odd, you know. They start thinking that, come on, I'm modern, intelligent, well-educated. I live in a Western society where I get, you know, proper information every day. And maybe carry on eating animals, it's a bit weird. And and the more people like me tell them that, oh my gosh, it's so weird. What do you know? You know, you carry on. The more I think, and that's what we do. We are not hippies. With long hair and sandals and grain eating. No. Not at all. Yeah. So I think that's changing, and that's I'm pushing very hard for that.
Oh, and it's definitely becoming more normalized. I mean, I see it, like the even press coverage now versus how it used to be 6-7 years ago. There were definitely many years there that I definitely felt like a big outsider. Not to say that it's the norm now, but you can definitely feel that the knowledge about the scale and the brutality of animal agriculture is becoming more well known, and usually first they think about it through a sustainability lens, but once you dive deeper, you can't help but see the reality of it. That has nothing to do with sustainability, but more to do with it's just this not the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
Do you get, you know, this may sound like a random side question, but I'm sure you get, being someone with your background, do people come to your restaurant or others when you first started to make the shift in your menu turn to you and say, but Alexis, what about cream and butter? Like, how are you going to make a menu and how are you going to create food without that? And I'm sure you figured it out. Do you make that all again on your own, or do you rely on certain products? What's your approach to that in your cooking in general?
Well, on the use of cream and butter and things like milk. I mean, to be fair, it's so easy now to find plant-based alternatives. I recently did a blind test of different kind of plant-based butter, and they were all so good. For a moment I thought I was being fed animal-based butter. So we use them. It's part of our integral part of the way we have totally brought them into our recipes, proudly, very proudly, and we support. And I'm always happy to support, someone who has cracked the plant-based mascarpone, for example. For me, it's like. It's a sense of relief, you know. I said, my gosh, we're going to be able to have amazing tiramisu without plant. This is for me, it's delightful.
Yeah.
Being able to to see, and the future, you know. Don't start me on stem cells things, because I am so hopeful about that. I have seen it. I've tasted it recently. I was very lucky to try it. A terrine de foie gras made by this French company called Gourmet out of stem cell taken from the egg, the duck egg. So, you know, the abuse was really minimal, and they managed to create this terrine which tastes just like the one I had, you know, 20 years ago, and tasted so delicious. And so maybe during my lifetime I'll be able to get my liver fat again with some delicious foie gras. You know, stem cells foie gras. I mean, I'm super hopeful because, as I said, I talk about the ingenuity of the human being. Some think they are doing it for the planet, but every time they save an animal life with that kind of product, it's mission accomplished as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and you're sitting at the cutting edge of it because you're using the best of your decades of experience on the culinary side and merging it. And keeping an open mind, not staying traditional, keeping an open mind about new technologies. And those companies need chefs like you to be able to push the envelope on what's possible with their food, to almost prove that, you know, like this is the future, and we're the future is already here. It's only a matter of time.
Absolutely. And I have put my energy recently. I was asked to go and cook for 25 partners in one of the biggest investment bank in Switzerland, who needed to be convinced that, you know, the plant-based future is real. And they asked me, they said, can you go and cook for them? Because those 25 partners, they still think that in 20 years' time, people will be eating, you know, fillet of beef and lobster thermidor or whatever. And I want them to realize that they need to put money, they need to invest in startups, you know, in the food tech industry. And for that, they need to eat your food. So I went there and I had lunch speech with them and I cooked my food. And I can assure you, they did not miss animal at all. And there are those people who eat in Michelin star restaurant and they go and have fillet of sea bass with cream sauce and langoustines in a armorican sauce or whatever. Anyway, I talked to them and I said, look, this is the future. This is where you need to put all of their resources, not only to save the planet, but also to save you know, to for the future of the human beings, because this is what they are going to be asking. Don't worry, we are here, we are cooking the future. You need to finance it. And I do that. You know, I talk to people, I meet a lot of people, and I want to convince them, and I want them to eat my cuisine to convince them as well.
Yeah. And this perfectly aligns with my next and final question, which is, what do you hope the world will be eating in the year 2050?
Ah, yes, that's very interesting. Well, I'm hoping that they will eat delicious food that's good for them. I think I know what they are going to eat. They are going to eat 3D printed Wagyu steak made out of the best, the most valuable Kobe beef on the planet. Someone has taken one stem, has created this mass, and this mass has been printed in exciting, delicious shape that we are cooking. And actually, this meat is so good for you, tastes so good, that you'll make sure that no animal is being killed, because the minute we kill, we can't eat it anymore. So we have reversed the whole world of killing to enjoy. No, you need to keep them alive to enjoy them. And I think that's what people will be eating. The future will not be much different, I think, of what we are eating. There will be maybe a few changes, but I think the food is going to be as delicious, because as a race, us human beings, we can do so much better than what we are doing. And I know that. I'm very, very hopeful that we will be creating, you know, an array of delicious food that tastes like the planet without impacting anybody that live on it, and obviously not impacting the planet itself.
Well, Alexis, I thank you so much for all the work that you're doing. I am really fascinated by everything you just outlined today. I can't wait to try the food myself. And I appreciate you taking the time today to chat with me. This has been an absolute pleasure.
No, that was a pleasure. Pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. And I look forward to cooking for you when you are in London.
You've been listening to Eat for the Planet with Nils Zacharias. If you enjoyed this conversation and would like to show your support, all you have to do is subscribe to this show and rate and review it. To learn more about this podcast or my work, go to eftp.co. That's eftp.co. Thank you for listening.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.